The house smelled of damp wool and old paper. Wren stood in the center of the hall, her hand resting on the banister, and listened to the silence. It was not the peaceful quiet of a sleeping town. It was the held breath of a creature waiting for a trap to spring. She had spent the morning at the desk, pretending to sort invoices, pretending that the ledger could be tamed by arithmetic. But the numbers were not the problem. The problem was the space between them, the gap between what the book said had happened and what the town remembered. Arthur Gable, Thomas Mercer. 47 names, according to the Birmingham manifests, she had not yet seen, but 47 ghosts, according to the silence that followed her name. She needed to see the old records, not the neat, red-bound volumes in the office the ones Silas kept locked behind his desk, the ones that summarized the business in tidy columns of profit and loss. She needed the raw data, the intake logs, the crematory registers from before her father died, the ones that might show, in her father's precise, unadorned hand, exactly what had been done with the bodies that never returned to their families. She knew where they were kept. She had been a child once when the funeral home was still hers alone, before Silas moved in, before the money grew tight and the secrets grew longer. There was a door at the back of the library, behind the tall bookshelf that had always leaned slightly to the left. A door with a brass keyhole, tarnished black with age. The old records room. Her father had called it the Chronicle Vault, though it was little more than a narrow closet with shelves that reached the ceiling. He had told her it was for things that must not be forgotten. She had assumed, foolishly, that it contained only receipts. She walked down the hall, her shoes making no sound on the runner carpet. The house was empty. Silas would not be back from his rounds until evening. He had mentioned something about the railway station, about a telegram that needed to be answered, about the usual deflections that kept him away from the office for hours at a time. She had the house to herself. She had the morning. She had the key, which she had lifted from the hook by the kitchen door while pouring tea, while telling herself she was only borrowing it, while the guilt sat heavy in her stomach like a stone. The key was cold in her palm. Brass, heavy, worn smooth by decades of use. She had expected resistance. She had expected the lock to seize, to resist her touch, to remind her that this house was not hers, that she was an intruder in her father's legacy. But the key turned easily, too easily, as if the lock had been oiled recently, as if Silas had known she would come. The door opened inward with a sigh of displaced air. The room was dark, the windows long since boarded up, the only light spilling in from the hallway behind her. She stepped inside, closed the door, and let the darkness take her. The smell hit her first. Not the formaldehyde of the embalming room, not the lilies of the parlor. This was older, drier. The scent of dust and decay and something metallic, like old pennies or dried blood. It clung to the back of her throat. She fumbled for the wall, her fingers finding the switch for the gas jet, a modern addition, installed by her father in the 90s, a concession to convenience that he had always grumbled about. The burner hissed, flared, and then cast a sickly yellow glow over the shelves. They were packed tight, rows upon rows of ledgers, bundles of letters tied with string, glass jars containing locks of hair and faded photographs, and smaller books intake logs, crematory registers, physician's certificates. Everything was labeled in her father's hand, the ink faded to brown, the paper brittle at the edges. She ran her fingers along the spines, feeling the texture of the years. 1784, 89, 92, 2003. The timeline stretched back further than she had realized, further than she had wanted to know. She pulled the register for Arthur Gable. The pages were stiff, reluctant to turn. She found the entry, October 14th. Man, 61, cardiac failure. Next of kin, Mrs. Eleanor Gable. Service, standard cremation. Fee, £18. She turned the page. Nothing. She turned another. And another. The register ended 3 weeks later with no mention of where the body had gone, no notation of the ashes being returned, no signature from the bereaved wife acknowledging receipt. She pulled another, Thomas Mercer. March 3rd, male, 73, natural causes. Next of kin, none listed. Service, standard cremation. Fee, £12. Again, nothing, no confirmation of return, no record of the urn being delivered, just the entry and then silence. She pulled another, and another. The pattern was absolute. Every cremation, every body, every name on the ledger ended in the same place, with a fee charged, a service rendered, and then nothing. No trail, no proof, no accountability. It was as if the bodies had simply vanished into the earth, into the smoke of the crematory, into the ash that Elias Halloway had purchased by the sack from the timber mill and shaken into ceramic vessels to be handed to grieving families. Wren pressed her palms flat against the top of the shelf, feeling the vibration of the house through the wood. The floorboards hummed. The walls breathed. And somewhere, beyond the door, beyond the library, beyond the wall that separated her from the rest of the house, she heard a footstep. It was faint, muffled by the thickness of the walls and the distance, but it was there, a shift of weight, a pause, then another step closer. She froze, her hand went to her mouth, stifling a gasp. The light buzzed overhead, steady and indifferent. The shelves loomed around her, towering and oppressive, filled with the accumulated weight of 40 years of lies. She wanted to run. She wanted to tear the ledgers from the shelves and scatter them across the floor and burn them all. But she stayed. She stood rooted to the spot, listening, waiting, her heart hammering against her ribs like a trapped bird. The footsteps stopped, just outside the door. She could hear breathing now. Slow, measured, deliberate. Not the hurried breath of someone walking quickly, but the calm, controlled respiration of someone who knew exactly where they were, who had been waiting for this moment, who had known she would come. Silas. She did not need to see him to know it was him. She could feel his presence pressing against the door, a weight in the air, a heat in the room that had nothing to do with the gaslight. He was standing on the other side of the wood, listening to her breathing, listening to the rustle of pages, listening to the silence of a granddaughter who thought she was alone. "Wren," he said, his voice was muffled by the door but clear enough, calm, almost gentle. "I thought you were in the office." She did not answer. She could not. Her throat had closed, sealed shut by fear and guilt and the terrible, undeniable certainty that he had known, that he had always known, that he had let her come here, let her open the door, let her stand in this room surrounded by the evidence of her father's crimes because he wanted her to see, because he wanted her to understand. "Wren, love," he said again, softer now, "open the door, we need to talk." She took a step back. Her shoulder bumped against the shelf, sending a shower of dust drifting down from the top row. The particles caught the yellow light, swirling in the air like tiny, suspended stars. She wiped her face with the back of her hand, feeling the grit on her skin, feeling the tears that had begun to gather in her eyes but would not fall. "I'm not going to hurt you," Silas said, "but you can't stay in there. The floor in this room, it's not safe. It's been rotting for years. Your father knew it. I've told him, I've told you. Some doors shouldn't be opened, Wren, not because they're forbidden, but because what's behind them isn't meant for the living." She pressed her ear to the wood. She could hear the faint creak of his boots, the rustle of his coat, the low, rhythmic sound of his breathing. He was not leaving. He was not going to the station. He was not answering a telegram. He had been here the whole time, waiting, watching. "Why are you here, Silas?" she whispered. The words came out thin, fractured, barely audible. There was a pause, a long, heavy silence that stretched between them like a wire, taut and vibrating. "Because I love you," he said finally, "and because I love your father, and because what we did, what he did, it wasn't for greed, it was for survival. And if you walk out of that room with those ledgers in your hands, you won't just be destroying his memory. You'll be destroying this town. You'll be destroying me. And you'll be destroying yourself." She closed her eyes. The darkness behind her lids was deeper than the room, darker than the shelves, heavier than the weight of 40 years of buried bodies. She thought of Maeve Collins, sitting in her cottage at the end of Bramble Lane, holding a urn that was too light, wondering why her husband's ashes felt like nothing. She thought of Mrs. Gable, writing to her, asking if she would call, asking if she would remember. She thought of the 47 names, the 47 families, the 47 lies that had been sold as comfort. And she thought of the key in her pocket, still warm from her hand, still heavy with the promise of truth. "I'm not going to take anything," she said. Her voice was steadier now, clearer. "I'm just going to look." "Looking is taking," Silas said. "And you don't know what you're looking for, Wren. You don't know what you'll find. And once you find it, you can't unfind it. You can't unsee it. You can't go back to the brass and the lilies and the polite lies. Once you step into this room, you're in it. With me, with him, with all of them." She opened her eyes, the yellow light buzzed, the dust settled, and she made her choice. She did not open the door. She did not move. She stood in the center of the room, surrounded by the weight of the past, and she listened to her uncle breathe on the other side of the wood, and she waited for the moment when the house would decide who was right. The footsteps retreated, slowly, deliberately, fading down the hall, away from the library, away from the door, away from her. She did not follow. She did not call out. She stood in the silence, in the dust, in the yellow light, and she let the ledgers remain where they were, unread and unjudged, waiting for the next time she would be brave enough or foolish enough to look again. Outside, the wind picked up, rattling the boarded windows and whispering against the glass like a voice trying to get in. Wren Halloway stood motionless in the old records room, her breath held tight in her chest, waiting for the house to tell her what to do next. She did not move until the silence became heavy enough to break, her hand resting on the cold brass handle of the drawer, feeling the weight of the ledger within.